This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to The Bigger Picture. It's Health and Living. It is our doctor in the house who's come in. And I have with me, of course, Dr. George Lee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very good. Well, I'm very excited for two reasons. Number one, it's a budget day after all, right? While
yes,
we're having
is.
This conversation, you know, makers and shakers of the country is making decisions about how to spend the money.
Okay,
so we're
crossed.
Excited. Fingers crossed. Or how to save the money.
Yes.
Right, okay. So, and the other thing is that, you know, I'm excited because all three of us are wearing pink.
More or less, yes. And that third person is, of course, Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang from CARIF, Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation. Dr. Teo, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And we have you with us because, of course, every October, the medical world and hopefully a lot of the random rest of the world as well goes pink for Pink October.
What? It's been fantastic. Actually, awareness in Malaysia is increasing all the time, and we're getting a lot of requests where people just want to know more about either the signs and symptoms or know what is cancer for two reasons. Unfortunately, cancer is rising in incidence, so people are coming forward because they see someone that's affected. And the second reason is I think more and more people are reversing their views towards cancer and not viewing it so much as a stigma, but one in which if you raise awareness, you can do something about it. And that's very encouraging.
Mm. I mean, Soo Hwang, obviously you're in today. We're very excited because October and November usually is a busy time for you, right? Because you need to raise awareness and funding and all sorts of things for your, you know, NGO. And then on top of that, you know, these are two important months to raise awareness for women's health and men's health, really, isn't
yes,
it? So,
right.
I mean, hence we have actually today, 21st of October is the day where it's recommended that it's supposed to be, you know, Pink October Breast Cancer Awareness Month and also Pink October Breast Cancer Awareness Week for men as well, right? And today, apparently, 21st of October, all of us are supposed to wear pink to bring awareness. But, you know, a lot of my patients turn up to the clinic and say, why are you wearing pink? Right? You know, it's like, you know, so I'm just wondering, what do you think is the impact of all these awareness? I mean, compared to, like, obviously in the UK, US, and, you know, are we really kind of like bringing a lot of awareness? And also, what sort of contribution can activities and campaigns like this bring to CARIF?
Right. So, well, first off, we've changed name.
Oh,
so
right.
we haven't been on the show for that long. No, right. But we've actually changed name and we're no longer called Cancer Research Initiatives Foundation. That in itself is a mouthful, and that was one of the reasons why we changed name. And we're just called Cancer Research Malaysia now.
All right.
So what started off as an initiative has changed name because I think it was very difficult to get it out in a mouthful and people also didn't understand what we were trying to do.
CARIF.
So,
if you say CARIF is like careful who. There were too many confusions. I miss the old name because it kind of rolls off your tongue a bit. But we're now called Cancer Research Malaysia and we couldn't come up with an acronym. So maybe that's a task for you to kind of, I think.
CRM is not too bad, right?
CRM is not too bad.
It's also Commercial Radio Malaysia, to be fair.
It's also Customer Relationship Management,
which is also not good.
Okay. We've had a couple, but maybe that's something for another day.
Actually, Cancer Research Malaysia is just, you know, it's exactly what it's supposed to do, right? It's like Cancer Research UK works extremely well. I'm sure Cancer Research Malaysia is a great name for it.
It is. So we're excited with that new name. But coming back to the issue at hand in terms of whether maybe Pink October has lost its gloss a little bit, I would say no. What we're seeing is that the effort is more grassroots, you know, rather than having very, very big one glitzy evening, for example, you're having a lot of companies that are coming forward to have small events. So hospitals that have a small event that the nurses take charge of and decorate everything pink so that they raise awareness to everyone who is just coming into the hospital. Companies who are doing something for their employees, so they just have a small talk within their organization to give it as a safe space where people can talk about cancer, raise awareness, know what does it mean for them and what can they do about it. And I think within that context of raising awareness so that people can do something about it, that's something very encouraging and something that we should continue.
Oh, it can come in many scales, right, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And considering that there are so many breast cancer awareness events and fundraisers, you know, I suppose the thing that people want to know, aside from awareness, is does it actually get anyone closer to preventing or curing the disease? You know, there is, of course, always the wish for a cure. Everyone wants every disease to have a cure. Are we getting any closer to that for breast cancer?
I'm really optimistic about breast cancer. I think, you know, in terms of advances and where we've got to, we're certainly finding three major things that are making a difference in terms of curing cancer. The first is we used to think that breast cancer is one disease. Well, it's one geography, right? And how many types of cells are there? It must be one disease. But we now know from a lot of research that breast cancer is at least 10 different types of diseases. And that differences in diseases translates to different types of treatment.
What do you understanding mean by that? You know, breast cancer is actually 10 different types of diseases.
So if you were to look at the genetic profile of the tumour itself, you'll find that some of the cancer arose from some types of cells due to some types of genetic changes. Mm. So a classic example would be if you had an estrogen receptor positive cancer, you're given a drug that is an anti-hormonal treatment that targets the estrogen. If you are HER2 positive or ERBB2 positive, you're given a drug that targets the ERBB2 gene. So this is what we mean by different types of cancer. That instead of saying you have breast cancer and therefore you should have this treatment, we're now saying, well, you have this type of breast cancer and on the basis of this type of breast cancer, this is the treatment that's most appropriate for you. This causes a lot of confusion, right? So if you're sitting next, if you line up 10 women with breast cancer, how come I have this treatment, but this makcik has this treatment, and this young lady has this treatment, how come all of our treatments are different? That's because we're getting better at understanding which treatment works best for which women, and which chemotherapy may not even be needed for some women. And I think we're really making a big change by understanding the molecular genetics of cancer. So I'm optimistic about that. The second reason why I'm really optimistic is because we're starting to find that, you know, in the past, we talk about lung cancer, and lung cancer is 90% preventable, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about colorectal cancer, and it's 50, 60% preventable. So when we talk about breast cancer, how much is preventable?
Don't know. Right, okay. Is it preventable? Because you would imagine that breast cancer, many people associate that with genetic, right? You can't really change your genes, can you?
Yeah. But the truth is that the majority of breast cancer is due to age of menarche, how many children you have, et cetera, et cetera.
So right? There's protective and risk factors.
That's right. So if you're going to prevent breast cancer in a wide scale for a lot of women, what you're going to say is actually all we're going to go completely against women's equality and basically say all women need to have children starting from the age of 18, have 6 children each, breastfeed each of them for 3 to 4 years, so continue having children and breastfeed until you're essentially menopause, then your risk of breast cancer is one-third what it is today.
Right.
So the harsh reality is that at this current point, we know that only 10% of breast cancer is preventable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what do we do about that? Well, what we're doing at the moment is we're starting a new research study. We've got new research to show that physical activity is associated with risk to breast cancer. We know that intake of soy is associated with reducing risk to breast cancer. So we're just about to launch a prevention study to help Malaysians understand whether if you know that you're at higher risk of cancer because your mother's been affected or your sister's been affected, then help us do this research study where we can really find out, can we do any interventions that can reduce the risk of cancer? Mm. So I'm optimistic that's the second reason why I'm optimistic. I think we now know more about risk factors, so we can take that forward.
I mean, obviously, it's quite exciting that, you know, Cancer Research Malaysia is doing a lot of work and then pushing this forward. I think I want to get Klang Valley to join the conversation. Three things I would like to know is that, do you think that something like Pink October, you know, Blue November, something like that, does it kind of like strike your fancy to bring out awareness in diseases? And also, do you have any way that you think, you know, fundraising, a new way of raising awareness or fundraising might be useful? And also the opportunity to ask Professor, you know, Teo, what are the latest research that's available done by Cancer Research Malaysia that can actually push forward the frontier of science?
As always, of course, if you have any questions also, you know, just about breast cancer, about your health, give us a call. That number is 03-77109. You can also text 0162019000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, we find out about the cost of running events like Pink October, like Movember, and we also get into the issue of research. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, and I have with me our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, as well as Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang from Cancer Research Malaysia. We're talking today about Pink October. We're also going to drag in Movember in a little bit because, of course, Dr. George is here.
That's right.
So we will get to that. But in the meantime, I would like to hear from you. You know, do you have any questions about breast cancer? Do you think Pink October is all it's cracked up to be? We'd love to hear from you. That number to call is 03-77109000. You can also text us with your thoughts at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Professor, why do you think the pink ribbon has really caught on? I mean, some might say, the more cynical among us might say, it's great marketing, you know. but of course, it's hard to say that about a thing that is good for one's health. You know, it's like, okay, if it's for a good cause, we don't call it that. But of course, it kind of is.
It's great marketing because how easy is it that you can just get a piece of ribbon, cut it, turn it one round, and it becomes a symbol of breast cancer, right? It doesn't get more simple than that. But I think that captures the essence of why Estee Lauder came up with this symbol for breast cancer in the first place.
Yeah.
Because you don't want something that is too glamorous, because too glamorous means that it really is only relevant for certain people. Whereas if you make it really simple, and you can then communicate a message which in many circles is still taboo, then hopefully it will open doors. Many of the people who support us, from our board to our volunteers and so on, use a pink ribbon just as a point of opening up a conversation, because you can't go up to someone and say, hey, I want to tell you about breast cancer. That doesn't really work. You know, it kind of kills conversations. But if a guy is wearing a pink ribbon, you'll be like, what's that?
Or even a pink shirt, right?
Or even a pink shirt. Absolutely. You look nice in a pink shirt today, George.
Not too sure about that.
No, it
works. That's right. It works, right. I mean, you know, Lynn was absolutely right that, you know, in some way, the Pink October, it's a victim of its own success in some way, because it all started with a humble, you know, somebody called Haley, who actually gave out a pink ribbon for their own granddaughter and daughter who suffered from breast cancer in California in the 80s. And in 1991, the Susan K. Komen Foundation, they gave it out for a New York marathon in order to do that. And subsequently, you know, Estee Lauder took over. And now many people say it's a lot of commercial association. I mean, in the very beginning, there were commercial associations with AstraZeneca and also with Estee Lauder. What do you think about that? That's sort of like, do we need that industry support?
I think we do need to think about, I mean, this begs a very big question about what is corporate CSR and where does conflict of interest end, if you like, or is conflict of interest even discussed when you have private public partnerships, right?
Indeed.
But I think in many circumstances nowadays, there are a lot of guidelines on how to deal with conflict of interest. For many, at least a lot of the companies that work with us, I don't see an overt need to do the marketing. Actually,
right.
I see very much, it's turning much more to become one in which they're trying to help their employees because cancer is getting more common. So it's about trying to raise awareness among their own. And CSR has not just been about doing their own bottom line, but actually doing something that will mean something for the community in which
genuinely, unconditionally offer help rather than it's good. I mean, because, you know, if you look at certain criticism, people will just say, well, there's a certain degree of, you know, commercialization and that sort of thing. But it's not all bad, right? Commercialization, because we need a lot of funding for a lot of events and campaigns because they cost a lot of money to bring awareness.
And I mean, why hasn't that worked for everyone else? I guess was my follow-on from that. You know, so if we have a campaign that has succeeded to the extent that it's now transcended its original purpose, you know, it's just become a catch-all for all things to do with breast cancer. Everybody knows pink is the color of breast cancer. Why hasn't this worked for other things? Why isn't prostate cancer, you know,
blue? Blue. It's supposed to be blue, but nobody knows. Nobody knows that.
You know, why isn't colon cancer red? You know, I don't know why the branding kind of hasn't caught on. I mean, even beyond cancer, of course. Why is that? What are the lessons we can kind of
learn
take
from the breast cancer?
I think the simple, my very simplistic interpretation would be that breast cancer is still the most common cancer in this country. Mm-hmm. So one in five cancers is going to be a breast cancer. One in three cancers in women is going to be a breast cancer. And the second is there are a lot more survivors of breast cancer. So we're getting so much better at treating breast cancer. There's a whole community of survivors out there. That basically means that you will invariably know someone who has had breast cancer, has survived breast cancer, and if it's someone that means something to you, it's a connection. You are in a community of touched individuals that doesn't want to see that happen in other people or want to make sure that you put more survivors on the street. Mm. And that's the reason, in my view, why Pink October has got a lot more traction than other diseases. So, for example, Steve Jobs died of cancer. Do most people remember what cancer he had?
It's pancreatic, but there is no corresponding branding or colour.
Absolutely. You know, and that's because pancreatic cancer is incredibly rare. Mm. So for 5,000 new breast cancer cases per year in Malaysia, pancreatic cancer is probably less than 300
and,
a year.
And sadly, there are not that many survivors.
Yeah. That was my second point. So unfortunately, about 90% of patients will die within the first year. And because of that, you're not many survivors. You know, sometimes it's not something that you want to talk about because you don't feel that there's something that you can do about it if you talk about it. So in breast cancer, the situation is very different. If you are breast aware, if you present with early disease, you can cure it. So the call to action is very obvious because you can do something about it. It's incredibly powerful if there's an action that leads, translates to an action that's impactful. That's where you get groups of people that are motivated towards the cause.
Yeah. In other words, what you're suggesting is that Pink October itself is a celebration of its success, really, because of so many survivors, and also, you know, it's a common condition that actually affects, although many women, but the thing is that the survivor is good, and also that push a lot of momentum on research and so on and so forth.
Yeah. I think it's also difficult with prostate cancer. So just to finish the point on prostate cancer, the prostate cancer is challenging because even in the medical community, there isn't a consensus on whether to screen or not screen. Right?
True,
do PSA or no do PSA?
Oh, we can
start that debate.
Okay,
and there is no consistency.
Well, that's the story of men's life, really, isn't it?
Well, we will get to that. But we did have a question from a listener, Jaya, who says, please explain, and I'm not sure how to pronounce this, whether it's binine or...
Benign.
No, it's B-I-N-I-N-E. I just had a benign removed from the right breast. Can this spread and reoccur? Is it cancerous?
Well, it depends on what type of benign. So there are many types of benign lumps. 9 out of 10 lumps that occur in a woman's breast is not cancer. And you can't tell by just touching it. So you can't feel on the outside and say this is benign, this is cancer, this is a cyst. You just can't tell. So most of the time, a doctor needs to put in a needle, take what is called a biopsy sample or take a surgical sample, look at it under the microscope and then decide whether it is going to be something that will progress on to become cancer or not. The majority of lumps that are found in young women is something called a fibroadenoma, and most fibroadenomas are benign and they don't have a higher risk to develop other cancers.
If you're listening today, we're talking about Pink October, but we're also talking about how its success story, its critiques, whether it works, whether it's the way forward, whether other diseases should take it on. If you'd like to give us a call, whether it's got anything to do with breast cancer as a whole, or whether it's to do with does Pink October work? We'd love to hear from you. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we acknowledge that right now the budget's going on. We're not kind of existing in a bubble, and we'll be talking about it in full later on the evening edition. But here, in the meantime, it seems prudent to talk about funding for healthcare because, as we know, there are concerns over where that's going to go. And when it comes to research and how that works, is there is funding determined by the prevalence of the cancer and by the power of the movement? Because, of course, cancer is very personal to everybody. Just because there are a lot of breast cancer survivors doesn't mean that someone listening with liver cancer right now might feel that they are less important or should be less served by the medical community. But does that end up happening? Is there a lot of money that goes to breast cancer purely by virtue of awareness?
I think in order to be able to do impactful science and really be able to study a disease, you need the resources to be able to do so. And that's not just funding. That also means you need to have the patient population to study. You also need the tissue samples from the tumor itself to be able to study. And if you don't have these things, it's actually very, very difficult to study a disease. So I might feel very emotionally connected to a child who has a brain cancer, for example, and I want to study that disease. I want to be able to make that the mission of my life, right? Mm-hmm. But it's actually almost impossible because I might only have 10 patients with that particular type of cancer. And even if I collect it for the next 10 years, I might only have 100 patients in total. Whereas in our research study, we now have close to 3,500 breast cancer patients because it's a much more common disease. Mm. So it's more than just whether
the mandate is channeled to certain things. It's about the relevance and also the availability of the research material as well.
You're absolutely right.
So if I ask Lynn's question in a different way to say that how much of your funding in percentage actually channel to what diseases, how would you answer that question?
I don't have that number in front of me. The way that Cancer Research Malaysia makes that decision is we go through what we call a peer review process. So our local reviewers we want to set international standards. So the way we have done this is all of our research programs are sent to experts in that specific field. So the breast cancer programs are sent to breast cancer experts from top scientists all over the world. They review what they think is the best, they rank it, and then our scientific advisory board makes decisions on what is internationally competitive or what is strategically important at the national level. And only when we meet that mark is funding diverted into that program.
Oh, wow. So basically, it depends on the quality of the work rather than, you know, how many proportion will automatically channel to what disease.
Absolutely. I think that's the way to go, because when resource is tight, you want to put your funding where it's the most impactful. And as economies and the budget becomes tighter and tighter, focus on quality is even more important, because that's what it means by integrity, right? You don't raise funds and then put it into crap science just because people say you should be studying this disease. Yeah, right. Well, if you can't make something impactful out of it, you're pouring money down the drain. You should be putting money where you can make an impact.
We have a couple of callers on the line now. We'll start off with Yong. Good afternoon, Yong.
Hi, Yong.
Good afternoon, Dr. George, Julian, and Doctor.
Yeah.
So this is for the female gender. And also, I think it, in a small way, affected the male gender. So, unfortunately for us, we just hitch a ride in this program. Maybe in less than a minute, doctor, maybe you just put some light on the...
Yeah, so you say for men, we just tumpang lah. Yeah.
yeah, that's right. Yeah. We're hitching the ride.
Okay.
Listen,
yeah, thank you.
Yong.
Yeah, so I mean, what Yong is suggesting is that, you know, so because I think in many ways also female cancer research and screening has been a lot more advanced compared to male, screening. It's probably not, but it's by default probably a lot of men come forward later in the disease progression, and therefore, you know, we are following, you know, like what Yong suggesting, that, you know, we tumpang lah, on the success, and we learn a lot from the breast cancer. You know, is that true?
So I would like to, before I answer that question, I just had a comment for you, Yong, which is that if you think about it, you know, maybe just speculate for a while. How many breast cancers do you think are detected by men? How many lumps that occur in a woman's breast is actually picked up by a guy? And it's the guy that says, you know, no, don't worry, I'll take the kids to school. You go and do a mammogram.
All right.
Well, that happens more often than we think. Yes. So the men in our life have no... They're not just there to tumpang.
All right.
They're really there to do something about it. So the next time you are in contact with a breast, maybe think about it a little bit.
Right.
And what about the, if I'm getting this right, the number is about 1%. Is that right, of men who present with breast cancer? Because it's a very gendered disease, or at least we think of it that way. But men are also... Unlike prostate cancer, men can get breast cancer. Yes.
You're absolutely right. So in Malaysia, there's about 5,000 new cases of female breast cancer, women with breast cancer every year. So 5,000, and 50 men will get breast cancer every year. Mm. So the next question is, where's the male breast? Maybe this one George can take. Okay.
Well, you don't need to kind of like answer that. You just need to look around. There are lots of male boobs around.
I would rather not.
No, you'd rather not. Not a very pretty sight. No. Okay, we have the next caller.
We do. We have LTY. Good afternoon, LTY.
Afternoon, LTY.
Good afternoon, Lynn. Good afternoon, Josh Lee.
Yes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Professor Teo.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you all?
Very good. So okay. What's your comment? What do you think about Pink October?
Dr. Teo, okay. Now, according to your research, now for married woman, but who doesn't give birth, do you have any statistic to indicate what is the chances, all right? My second question I'm asking on behalf of my daughter. She has endometriosis, okay? Inflammation of the womb. She hasn't given birth because of some other problem, all right? My question is this, Professor Teo, is there a link between these two, breast cancer and cervical cancer? Because I believe some mutation happening, all right? Because maybe you have done some research. Can you tell the listeners? Okay, thank you very
much. Thank you, LTY.
Thank you.
Just to recap, you know, no children, null powers, and then will that predispose you to breast cancer?
Yes, not having children increases your risk of cancer, but only by a little bit. So I think in terms of looking to see whether you're married or not, in terms of cancer, is not the major determining factor. The more important one is how old you are and whether anyone in your family has got breast or other cancers.
And at what age they have
Absolutely,
breast cancer.
Absolutely, yeah. So if no one in your family has breast cancer and you're 20 years old, you have less than a 1 in 100 chance of developing cancer. But if no one in your family has got cancer and you are, say, 60 years old, then you have about a 1 in 20, maybe 1 in 15 chance of developing cancer. So in other words, risk of cancer increases as you go older, and it's not static. It's not one that you say, this is your risk and this is your life. It is essentially one that increases with age. And that's the reason why beyond 50 years old, we will say that regardless of whether you had children or no children, beyond the age of 50, every woman should go for a mammogram.
Starting to give birth at the age of 18 and then going on to have 10 kids throughout your life and you just...
Six.
Six, okay,
and,
sorry.
And breastfeeding all of them.
Yes.
Yeah, 4 years on average for each one.
10
yeah.
was
four
a catchy
years.
Number.
Yes.
but, okay, so having that amount of kids at such a young age is increasingly uncommon. But from what I understand, there's also a protective factor of having children below the age of 30. Is that correct?
You're absolutely right. So starting children from below the age of 30 does make a significant difference. But if you think about it, our average age of getting married is increasing. This is part of urbanization and development. You know, when in our parents' generation, people got married when they were 22, 23. Now it's actually close to 30 already. So if you're getting married when you're 29, 30, then the protective effect of having children is actually getting less. Having said that, breastfeeding does protect against breast cancer, and I think that's an encouraging trend. More women are now taking up breastfeeding and they are using pumps and other things. Of course, we don't know whether using pumps decreases your risk of cancer or not, but it's encouraging that we assume that it's so.
The lactation itself is...
You're continuing to produce milk, and that results in hormones that are being produced that hopefully, in some way, protects you against breast cancer.
If you've got any questions about breast cancer, if you'd like to weigh in on whether Pink October and other such awareness campaigns are really the way to go, give us a call. That number is 03-771-09000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And some people have indeed texted in. Isaac, for instance, wants to know, how advanced is the technology in Malaysia to treat cancers at the moment? Do patients have to go overseas?
Okay, let's put it specifically on breast cancer, you know. So, you know, how advanced are we? And you mentioned earlier on about, you know, Herceptins and a range of, you know, targeted therapy and new therapy. Do we have them available here in Malaysia?
Absolutely. I think that for cancers like breast cancer, where the surgery is pretty straightforward, I think you're not talking about very complex surgery, with all due respect to some very fantastic breast surgeons, but the surgery of breast cancer is actually relatively straightforward. Radiotherapy and chemotherapy is relatively straightforward. So it's very standard of care, and therefore, actually in the best hospitals in Malaysia, the survival for breast cancer patients is exactly the same as what it is in other countries. Mm. So there's no real need to go overseas. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
But is there a... when it comes to price, is that kind of equitable at the moment? Is that something that... Can everybody afford the best, I guess?
Malaysia is actually cheaper than Singapore by a lot. And one of the main reasons why that's the case is because the Ministry of Health regulates how much doctors can charge for every single procedure. Mm-hmm. Every single procedure is regulated by the Ministry of Health, whereas in Singapore, the doctors can charge whatever that they like. Yeah?
Mm. I mean, well, that comes to the charges. But what about, like, let's say, medicine afterwards? Because, you know, one of the worries that everyone has is that, you know, every day we have new advancement in technology and pharmaceutical interventions. And, you know, when it's available under NHS, you know, sometimes that is available, that sometimes that's not. But in Malaysia, you know, do we have that sort of equity for everybody to in order to have access to that sort of technology and pharmaceutical intervention?
I think in terms of equity to access, this is an issue that the Ministry of Health is really actively trying to solve, right? Because, and there are very few countries in the world that are solving this well. So the US are doing a crap job at looking at funding, because effectively when they see benefit of one treatment over another, they just accept it into their clinical practice guidelines. Mm. That's it. They basically say this treatment is better for you, regardless of the cost. And that basically means that for some treatments, it can cost $1 million, but only adds 3 months in your life. They still say it's in the guidelines. Mm-hmm. But other countries, particularly the European countries, are taking it differently. They're starting to use the term value-based medicine. Mm. And in value-based medicine, what you're actually doing is asking the question, if I extend your life by 1 year, and the cost of living or the quality adjusted life years is that same value, then I'm going to negotiate and say, if your drug is below that price of how much life you can extend, then the National Health Service will pay for it. If it's above that, the National Health Service will not pay for it. Mm. The key challenge is that currently the Ministry of Health only pays for drugs that are within 2 to 3 times of GDP.
Right.
Our GDP is tiny. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, most targeted therapies are not currently being provided under the Ministry of Health simply because we can't afford it yet as a country. Mm. It's not just the ministry's responsibilities. It's all of us. We really need to think, how do we get insurance to more individuals? How do we better protect ourselves so that when we need it, we're financially prepared?
Mm. A bunch of questions from listeners now. Firstly, what is meant by breast tissue that is too dense to know the outcome of the scan?
Okay. So basically, the breast comprises little balloons that are called lobules that makes the milk, and then little pipes that are called ducts that transport the milk from the lobules or the balloons to the nipple. So around these balloons and pipes are connective tissue that holds it all into a nice architecture. When you are young, most of the women who are under the age of 40, they have a lot of the lobules and the pipes and the connective tissue. That means that when you put a breast between X-ray plates to catch a mammogram, what happens is that all of these blocks the X-rays from going through, and therefore you'll see a lot of shadows, right? Mm-hmm. And when you see all those shadows, breast cancer also presents as a shadow. So if you already have a bright white background of shadows, then you can't see whether there's any new shadows at all, mm-hmm. which might be lurking behind. So that is the reason why for most of the time we do not recommend mammograms for women under the age of 40, because your breasts are so dense, we can't see anything anyway. Mm-hmm. As you grow older, the lobules, the balloons that make the milk, and the pipes that carry the milk to the nipple start to degenerate into fat. And fat allows the X-rays to go through much better. And therefore, your general background becomes black. And when you have something that looks like cancer, it's a patch of white. And so it's easier to see breast cancer in an older woman using a mammogram, and not so easy in a younger woman. Mm.
So for a young woman, I'm presuming on behalf of the listener, assuming that she is a young woman who herself has been told this, that your you know, it's just too dense, then what are the options? Would it be an ultrasound?
Absolutely. An ultrasound should not be used as a screening tool, and that's because an ultrasound picks up a lot of things that look suspicious but actually isn't. So as a screening tool, it's too sensitive and gives out too many false results. But if it's used together with a mammogram, then it makes sense. Or if it's used to try and work out, is this lump something that is suspicious, then it makes sense. So that's what we mean by an adjunct ultrasound. That means you don't use it in isolation, just, okay, you know, you are scared, you're no lumps, you've got no family history, I'll just do an ultrasound. That's not recommended. Mm-hmm. But so if it's used with a mammogram, or if you have a lump, let's say you're a 35-year-old, you have a lump, then I go and do an ultrasound, see whether it's something that I should be suspicious about.
Right, so investigative as opposed to just general screening.
Absolutely. Okay. So when there's a symptom and you want to try and figure out what that symptom is, then it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today about Pink October and breast cancer. Up next, men enter the picture because Dr. George is here, so men always do. And we'll be talking about issues surrounding men's health as well and how that corresponds to Pink October. But we would still love to hear from you. If you've got any questions about breast cancer, do feel free to send them in. We'd also like to hear whether awareness campaigns for health are the best way to go. We'll be back after the short message from our sponsors. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living today. It is our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consulting neurologist, sitting in with me, Lee Chui Lin, as well as Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang from Cancer Research Malaysia. And we've been talking mostly about Pink October and breast cancer. Do keep your questions coming in. Now's the time to ask Professor Theo anything that might be on your mind. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Okay, we do have two sort of lingering messages, but first we'll take a call from Michael. Good afternoon, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, hi there.
Yeah. So what do you say? What do you think about Pink October?
I think it's great, but I've got a question from a man's side.
Okay.
Well, you know that men, when we get fat, sometimes we have man breath.
All right.
Or the more muscular guys, we have pecs and muscles.
Yes.
Does that predispose us to have breast cancer? And should I, as if my pecs are getting bigger and there are more muscular, do I need to go for mammograms?
Right, okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, first of all, I mean, what Michael described is called gynecomastia. I mean, essentially, it is a very common condition. The most common reason why people have that is because you're getting fat, really. And then there are other reasons why people get gynecomastia, such as medication. There are certain medication predispose you to that, and also change of your hormones. Like, for example, if you get excess amount of female hormone, you also get that. And then sometimes it's genetic conditions, such as Klinefelter's, you'll get that. But from what I understand is that it doesn't predispose you to breast cancer. And so what I'm trying to do is, you know, ask on behalf of Michael, for example, if he is worried and he found a lump, would he go for mammography or would he go for ultrasound scan, you know?
I think, so to kind of build on your story, you're absolutely right that there's no real evidence that bodybuilding or getting fatter in men increases your risk of breast cancer. I think what we know are the biggest risk factors for male breast cancer will be having someone in your family have breast cancer itself or have prostate cancer and pancreatic cancer or ovarian cancer. So these are cancers that are linked through the hormones, and if you have anyone in your family with those cancers, then the men in the family may have higher risk of male breast cancer. But they actually have a higher risk of prostate cancer mm-hmm. in those families than they do of male breast cancer.
So I guess following on Michael's question, just to kind of put it to rest, it's not as if the more tissue you have in the area, the more chances you have of getting breast cancer.
Depends on the type of tissue. So if, like George says, you've been exposed to a lot of female hormones, then the female hormones can cause certain types of cells to grow, and those can cause an increased risk. So there's finding that male breast cancer is increasing in incidence, you know, in countries that take a lot of oral contraceptives, for example. There's this urban myth, right?
Oh, right.
That the oral contraceptives
it gets
and other
in the
things.
Water.
Yes, that's such a common urban myth. myth that men are developing boobs because of the hormones that are found in the water, right? George, what do you think? No.
Well, I blame anything for my boobs, right? Yes, it's true. No, I have no idea. Well, no, I don't know how that, you know, the estrogen actually get into the water. But I would imagine I know the reasons why I'm having protruding chest is because I am overweight. And then that is the commonest reason why men has, gynecomastia, I think.
And have you ever considered your risk for breast cancer?
No, because, you know, it's very simple for men to do self-examination because it's a lot easier than women. Okay. So I actually ask, male patients to do self-examinations as well because, you know, 1% is still 50 people in Malaysia who are affected by breast cancer.
But I think the more important lesson for men is, you know, be aware of this thing called relative risk. You know, don't worry about the things which are not necessarily a very high risk, but be more concerned about the things that are absolutely the highest risk. So number one, heart disease. Number two, you know, cancers like prostate cancer and colorectal cancer. Men are ridiculously bad at eating fiber and they would love their beer and their steak and usually a 16-ounce steak if they can help
absolutely.
It, right? With no salad on the side. So...
I'm salivating. Right, okay.
It's inexplicable to me how
it's
men
live past
40. It's
a cancer on a stick, really. It's a cancer on a plate, really, if you can continue to live like that, right?
For some reason, I feel as if we have a lot of women texting and a lot of men calling. It's a very odd balance. But for a patient who has a benign lump in the breast, do you still need to have regular screenings? And how regular would that be? The patient was discharged from the hospital after 3 years of monitoring with a biopsy, mammogram, and ultrasound. I'm not sure 3 years there is. Is that a normal amount of time for a benign lump?
Well, I had a benign fibroadenoma when I was 22 years old, and essentially I had no monitoring thereafter. So, you know, it depends on the type of lump, like I said, yeah. If it's a lump that is not associated with an increased risk to future cancers and you're already still quite young in your 20s and there's no one in your family with cancer, then really the doctor will say, you know, come back if you have any symptoms. Mm-hmm. But if on the other hand, the lump turns out to be a hyperplasia, for example, which has got some characteristics that could put you at higher risk of future cancers, your mother already has cancer, maybe your aunt also has cancer, then under those circumstances, the doctor usually won't discharge you and continue monitoring you well into, you know, your older years because you are at a higher risk of developing cancer. So I don't think we should put it all in one bucket and say all benign lumps are the same. I think everything is different and it really is. If the doctor says that you have a benign fibroadenoma and there's no need for further screening because you're young, that's appropriate.
Incidentally, on the notes of benign condition, we were reminded to answer LTY's question. You know, he mentioned something about his daughter having endometriosis, which is a benign condition. Does that predispose his daughter to cancer?
Yes, it does. It is associated with certain types of ovarian cancer. And I don't think the link to endometrial cancer is very strong. It's linked to a very rare type of ovarian cancer. But endometriosis is incredibly common in the Asian population. Mm. So I think, you know, with regular, with proper management, clinical management, it shouldn't really be a problem. LTY's other question was about cervical cancer and whether it's linked to breast and endometrial cancer. Breast and endometrial cancers are largely hormonal diseases, whereas cervical cancer is a almost exclusively viral disease. So what it means is it's absolutely associated with the human papilloma virus. And if you're a girl aged between 9 and a woman up to the age of 26, you should really consider vaccination for the human papilloma virus. Mm-hmm. And go for screening. Mm. Pap smear.
A very important question. Hi BFM, as a breast cancer survivor, my tumour was removed via surgery. What can I do to feel better or normal again due to the scar?
I think it really depends on whether this particular patient had a mastectomy or a lumpectomy, and really whether the subsequent treatments like the radiotherapy did have any effect or not. And also it really depends for every woman. So for some women, it is important to, body image is really important. And under those circumstances, I think a plastic surgeon would be better at advising whether breast reconstruction or the skin skin discoloration or others can be corrected. And, you know, deal with the treatment first. Make sure that all of the treatment has been finished. So the surgery, the radiotherapy, chemotherapy has been finished. And then work out maybe with a plastic surgeon what you might need to do next.
If Angelina Jolie can do it, you know, most people can do it, really.
You're absolutely right. That's such a nice positive message.
Absolutely. Shot. It's where everyone was wearing pink today. So that's why we have the positive messages.
But soon we're going to hand it over. The baton is going to pass over to Blue Movember. Is
Blue
that
Movember,
right?
That's okay. Right, yeah.
Now, Blue Movember, Movember's caught on to some degree, but Blue hasn't really been associated that strongly.
Blue is a boy's kind of color, and it's somehow just kind of like a being, you know, tumpang, like Yong said, right?
But, I mean, Movember, would you say, has it been as impactful as Pink October? Are we headed in that direction?
Well, I mean, when I Google Pink October, you see Eiffel Tower being lit up in pink, the White House being lit up in pink, and then, you know, the House of Parliament in
UK. And the Twin Towers.
The Twin Towers, that's right. You know, it's like, I mean, the impact of that is just that everyone has that spirit of it. I mean, the only spirit that, you know, kind of like November get on is that some men grow some mustache. Archers. So, you know, I feel kind of, you know, small in comparison with the scale of Pink October. Therefore, you know, today I want to take this opportunity to find out, like, you know, how is Malaysia, I mean, you're involved in a lot of fundraising, a lot of awareness campaigns and things like that. What can we learn from, CARIF and subsequently Cancer Research Malaysia? I mean, what sort of evolution have you had the campaign activities over the last 10 years, for example? And also, what are you doing this year? Because we're going to learn from you.
Oh, you're going to learn from...
That's right. We're stealing ideas from you.
From
That's
the breast cancer campaigns.
That's right.
Well, I think number one is we have great, fantastic partners. So, for example, Simdabi LPGA have been supporting our... next Saturday is going to be Pink Saturday at the professional course or TPC, the ex-KLGCC, in conjunction with the Simdabi LPGA. So corporate partners like Simdabi LPGA, like Estee Lauder that lit up the Twin Towers in pink, help to raise this to an absolutely different level. Mm-hmm. So find your favourite corporate partner.
All right, so that's the first thing we need to do.
Really put their muscle behind us. Because for a small organisation that spends 90% of our income on research, we simply don't have the funding that's necessary to do things on such a large scale. Mm-hmm. So I think corporate Malaysia has a big role to play in terms of raising awareness. Mm-hmm. The second is, I think patients and their families are incredibly strong. And they are the engine and the, if you like, the ground force behind all of these campaigns. Because they turn up in droves, they come as volunteers, they come and do things for you. And it's a really humbling experience to really have a big group of people who come forward and say, you know, I don't have much, here's my 50 ringgit or whatever, but I hope that what you do will really help someone else in the future not go through what I went through. And that's a really humbling experience. Mm. So to have lots of people like that, and this is where the men are really coming in. Mm. So we're starting to see more and more men come up to me and accuse me. I have a couple of people in mind who really point blank accuse me and hold me to say, you know, when are you going to do something about prostate cancer?
Oh, right, okay.
So we have a small program on prostate cancer, but currently we only have 30,000 ringgit in the pot.
All right.
If we really want to do something impactful in prostate cancer, we really need to maybe raise 200,000 so that we can at least start a program. Mm-hmm. So in the prostate cancer program, we've been doing some genetics to try and understand as part of an international consortium which men are at risk of prostate cancer. We have a cohort of men with BRCA mutations, so we're looking to see how screening for PSA can help detect early prostate cancer in these men. And we have also done some biomarker studies to look to see whether a genetic abnormality linked to prostate cancer is common in the Malaysian population. Mm-hmm. But all these are tiny compared to what we've been able to achieve in breast cancer, because you're right, the movement for breast cancer is much greater, and that results in a lot more funding for us to be able to do the work, and we're just not there for prostate cancer.
While we talk about that cohort of men, I just need to interrupt very quickly because there is a message from a man who is 31, and he says, breast cancer runs in my family. My mother passed away from it. My grandmother survived it. I have two sisters. Recently, one discovered she had it. She's done chemo. She's still going through treatment. And she did the BRCA2 test, and it came back. She came back positive as a carrier. Me and my other sis also did that test, and unfortunately, we share the same genetic result. So my sister is going to join the risk management program. My question is, as a man, I suppose, do I need to join the program as well?
Absolutely. First off, I'm going to say that the options for BRCA carriers now are a lot more than they were in the past. So through research done at the University of Cambridge, actually it was research done in where I worked as a Royal Society Research Fellow in the Cambridge. And through that research, we've actually led to an understanding of different drugs or therapies that work specifically for BRCA carriers. And ironically, for ovarian cancer patients, you know, when they have this new drug, they actually have a better survival than women who don't have the BRCA mutation. So research is improving all of the time, and I hope that the caller would understand that we are making progress in this area and don't look at it as something of doom and gloom. At 31, then I don't think there's anything to be concerned with for the time being. His highest risk is for prostate cancer, and he probably should consider a regular PSA test from the age of 40. Not any earlier, because the incidence of prostate cancer is really in the 50s, even for BRCA carriers. For male breast cancer, it's a self-examination, and then there isn't a lot of risk to other cancers. So again, you know, I think the women are at higher risk, but the men can do something about it.
And just to close off today, what would your final message be on, well, Pink October as well as Movember? Let's give you your time.
Give me my time first. Okay. Well, actually, I've learned a lot today. You know, I realize that this amount of work that, you know, Cancer Research Malaysia has put in is phenomenal. And clearly, this is the forefront of research and everything. And I learned two things. Number one is that without the help of corporations, it's difficult to do that. And also, without the help of, patients groups, it was always impossible to do that. So I am determined one day we're going to light up the KL towers in blue, perhaps, you know, in one day. But with that, obviously, we need a lot of support from listeners, from people to donate, right? Because, you know, without donation, Cancer Research Malaysia will not sustain. I mean, how do people get involved to help you, let's say, you know, to push forward this, to make it into a bigger scale charity?
George, I should just appoint you as our champion fundraiser. You always manage to put a plug for us, and I didn't pay him
this. Okay.
He wore pink and everything.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm a big supporter.
Thank you, George. That's fantastic. So we are raising funds through the LPGA Turn Up for this cause. In addition, Estee Lauder is raising funds for us and joined their photo exhibition. In addition, we're doing something different. We are having a pink picnic in the park. So this is happening on the 26th of November. It's only 100 ringgit for a picnic for two people. We thought we'll try something very different this year. Log on to our website, which is www.cancerresearch.my, to find out more. And we'll be delighted to see many people there, including you, George.
Right, okay, right.
Okay,
and we've run out of time.
I'm sorry. You've been listening today to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.